File 26. Anyone who believes that a religious reformation can be achieved through the agency of a political organization shows that he has no idea of the development of religious conceptions and doctrines of faith, and how these are given practical effect by the Church. No man can serve two masters, and I hold that the foundation or overthrow of a religion has far greater consequences than the foundation or overthrow of a state, to say nothing of a party. It is no argument to the contrary to say that the attacks were only defensive measures against attacks from the other side. Undoubtedly, there have always been unscrupulous rogues who did not hesitate to degrade religion to the base uses of politics. Nearly always, such a people had nothing else in their minds except to make a business of religions and politics. But on the other hand, it would be wrong to hold religion itself, or a religious denomination, responsible for a number of rascals who exploit the Church for their own base interests, just as they would exploit anything else in which they had a part. Nothing could be more to the taste of one of these parliamentary loungers and tricksters than to be able to find a scapegoat for his political sharp practice. After the event, of course. The moment religion or a religious denomination is attacked and made responsible for his personal misdeeds, this shrewd fellow will raise a row at once and call the world to witness how justified he was in acting as he did, proclaiming that he and his eloquence alone have saved religion and the Church. The public, which is mostly stupid and has a very short memory, is not capable of recognizing the real instigator of the quarrel in the midst of the turmoil that has been raised. Frequently, it does not remember the beginning of the fight, and so the rogue gets by with his stunt. A cunning fellow of that sort is quite well aware that his misdeeds have nothing to do with religion. And so he will laugh up his sleeve all the more heartily when his honest but artless adversary loses the game and, one day losing all faith in humanity, retires from the activities of public life. But from another viewpoint also, it would be wrong to make religion, or the Church as such, responsible for the misdeeds of individuals. If one compares the magnitude of the organization as it stands visible to every eye with the average weakness of human nature, we shall have to admit that the proportion of good to bad is more favorable here than anywhere else. Among the priests there may, of course, be some who use their sacred calling to further their political ambitions. There are clergy who unfortunately forget that in the political melee they ought to be the paladins of the more sublime truth and not the abettors of falsehood and slander. But for each one of these unworthy specimens, we can find a thousand or more who fulfill their mission nobly as the trustworthy guardians of souls and who tower above the level of our corrupt epoch, as little islands above the sea swamp. I cannot condemn the Church as such, and I should feel quite as little justified in doing so if some depraved person in the robe of a priest commits some offence against the moral law. Nor should I for a moment think of blaming the Church if one of its innumerable members betrays and besmirches his compatriots, especially not in epochs when such conduct is quite common. We must not forget, particularly our day, that for one such there are a thousand whose hearts bleed in sympathy with their people during these years of misfortune, and who, together with the best of our nation, yearn for the hour when fortune will smile on us again. If it be objected that here we are concerned not with the petty problems of everyday life, but principally with fundamental truths and questions of dogma, the only way of answering that objection is to ask a question. Do you feel that Providence has called you to proclaim the truth to the world? If so, then go and do it. But you ought to have the courage to do it directly and not use some political party as your mouthpiece, for in this way you shirk your vocation. In the place of something that now exists and is bad, put something else that is better and will last into the future. If you lack the requisite courage, or if you yourself do not know clearly what your better substitute ought to be, leave the whole thing alone. But whatever happens, do not try to reach the goal by the roundabout way of a political party if you are not brave enough to fight with your visor lifted. Political parties have no right to meddle in religious questions except when these relate to something that is alien to the national well-being, and thus calculated to undermine racial customs and morals. If some ecclesiastical dignitaries should misuse religious ceremonies or religious teaching to injure their own nation, their opponents ought never to take the same road and fight them with the same weapons. To a political leader, the religious teachings and practices of his people should be sacred and inviolable. Otherwise, he should not be a statesman, but a reformer, if he has the necessary qualities for such a mission. Any other line of conduct will lead to disaster, especially in Germany. In studying the Pan-German movement and its conflict with Rome, I was then firmly persuaded, and especially in the course of later years, that by their failure to understand the importance of the social problem, the Pan-Germanists lost the support of the broad masses, who are the indispensable combatants in such a movement. By entering Parliament, the Pan-German leaders deprived themselves of the great driving force which resides in the masses, and at the same time they laid on their own shoulders all the defects of the parliamentary institution. Their struggle against the church made their position impossible in numerous circles of the lower and middle classes, while at the same time it robbed them of innumerable high-class elements, some of the best indeed that the nation possessed. The practical outcome of the Austrian Kulturkampf was negative. Although they succeeded in winning 100,000 members away from the church, that did not do much harm to the latter. The church did not really need to shed any tears over these lost sheep, for it lost only those who had for a long time ceased to belong to it in their inner hearts. The difference between this new Reformation and the Great Reformation was that in the historic epoch of the Great Reformation, some of the best members left the church because of religious convictions, whereas in this new Reformation, only those left who had been indifferent before and who were now influenced by political considerations. From the political point of view alone, the result was as ridiculous as it was deplorable. Once again, a political movement which had promised so much for the German nation collapsed, because it was not conducted in a spirit of unflinching adherence to naked reality, but lost itself in fields where it was bound to get broken up. The Pan-German movement would never have made this mistake if it had properly understood the psyche of the broad masses. If the leaders had known that, for psychological reasons alone, it is not expedient to place two or more sets of adversaries before the masses, since that leads to a complete splitting up of their fighting strength, they would have concentrated the full and undivided force of their attack against a single adversary. Nothing in the policy of a political party is so fraught with danger as to allow its decisions to be directed by people who want to have their fingers in every pie, but they do not know how to cook the simplest dish. But even though there is much that can really be said against the various religious denominations, political leaders must not forget that the experience of history teaches us that no purely political party in similar circumstances ever succeeded in bringing about a religious reformation. One does not study history for the purpose of forgetting or mistrusting its lessons afterwards, when the time comes to apply these lessons in practice. It would be a mistake to believe that in this particular case things were different, so that the eternal truths of history were no longer applicable. One learns history in order to be able to apply its lessons to the present time, and whoever fails to do this cannot pretend to be a political leader. In reality, he is quite a superficial person, or, as is mostly the case, a conceited simpleton whose good intentions cannot make up for his incompetence in practical affairs. The art of leadership, as displayed by really great popular leaders in all ages, consists in consolidating the attention of the people against a single adversary and taking care that nothing will split up that attention into sections. The more the militant energies of the people are directed towards one objective, the more will new recruits join the movement, attracted by the magnetism of its unified action, and thus the striking power will be all the more enhanced. The leader of genius must have the ability to make different opponents appear as if they belong to the one category, for weak and wavering natures among a leader's following may easily begin to be dubious about the justice of their own cause if they have to face different enemies. As soon as the vacillating masses find themselves facing an opposition that is made up of different groups of enemies, their sense of objectivity will be aroused, and they will ask, how is it that all the others can be in the wrong and they themselves and their movement alone in the right? Such a feeling would be the first step towards a paralysis of their fighting vigour. Where there are various enemies who are split up into divergent groups, it will be necessary to block them all together as forming one solid front, so that the mass of followers in a popular movement may see only one common enemy against whom they have to fight. Such uniformity intensifies their belief in the justice of their own cause and strengthens their feeling of hostility towards the opponent. The Pan-German movement was unsuccessful because the leaders did not grasp the significance of that truth. They saw the goal clearly, and their intentions were right, but they took the wrong road. Their action may be compared to that of an alpine climber who never loses sight of the peak he wants to reach, who has set out with the greatest determination and energy, but pays no attention to the road beneath his feet. With his eye always fixed firmly on the goal, he does not think over or notice the nature of the ascent. And finally, he fails.